This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
I'm Tony Bennett. Before I start, I would like to tell you a short, personal, and true story about Ping.
From the age of 13, when John Solheim's club building apprenticeship started in their Californian garage, he learned countless lessons about business and life from his father, Carsten Solheim. As the company graduated from putters to irons and woods, Carsten would decide whether a concept went forward by asking, "Does it make the ball go straighter?" The clubs Ping were making did perform better, and from our original small operation, we were transforming club design and manufacturing. Carsten Solheim revolutionized the modern golf club, and he set high standards for design and quality that other club makers had to follow if they wanted to compete. Carsten did this by constantly challenging himself and all employees to push their thinking and keep evolving in pursuit of the highest quality, best performing products possible. The imprint he left on the industry in so many areas helped establish Carsten as a widely respected and beloved visionary. He was a recipient of many accolades and awards, and he is the only golf club manufacturer in the World Golf Hall of Fame.
"Take the stairway, two flights up, and go through the first door on the right," said the poker-faced man in a white coat. These are the words that led to a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis for Marcella Neggers. Who knows what was going through the mind of this 11-year-old girl as she confidently took one step at a time on that stairway. Eventually she reached the top, turned the corner, and entered the room, where finally the pain in her right wrist would be correctly identified. Marcella Neggers is a good golfer, in fact she's a very good golfer. But it is her determination to play the game, a game which surgeons have said that she should give up, that is perhaps the most obvious characteristic of this straight-talking Dutch golf professional. During our conversation, Marcella reveals a strong competitive desire as she explains how she has pursued her goals and how she firmly believes that there is always a way to play golf. Please enjoy my conversation with Marcella Neggers. So Marcella Neggers, it's good to speak with you. I'm interested to hear your take on several subjects today. And I guess that we'll probably take several twists and turns as we go through this conversation. So let's just see where we end up. But I really wanted to start off by asking you, how did you first get starting to play golf?
Due to my parents. They were both a member of a golf club in Eindhoven. And I was a very good field hockey player, but because of the injury, I was not allowed to play hockey again. And then my dad said, "Okay, why are you not going to try and play golf?" And so the first half a year, I was like, I brought my hockey stick with me, and when the professional was there, and turned around, I took my hockey stick and started hitting balls
right
with the hockey stick instead of my golf clubs.
Yeah.
But after half a year, I met a guy there who was also starting playing golf, and we started together, and that was the beginning of no end.
And you both your parents played?
Yeah, my father still plays, and my mom quits.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about? Do you have brothers and sisters?
No.
No.
A dog.
A dog.
Yeah, it's not playing.
So you started pretty early, I think, about 11 years of age. And
yeah.
I suppose by today's standards, that's not very young, but it was much more common when you and I certainly were growing up and to start playing around the time of going to secondary school. So
yeah.
I'm interested to know your opinion on the best time to start playing golf.
That's a good one. I think when you do it like with all the fun things and all the, throwing balls and keep it as simple as you can start like within 7, 6 maybe, let's say around 7.
Mm-hmm. Do you work with kids very often?
I do, yeah.
And so when you start these kids, what does it look like? What does the program look like?
We always have a program on Sundays. These are 2 hours, and we always start with a warming up, with a fun thing like soccer or baseball, whatever it is. And then we try to do some rotational things, or some running things, just to get them tired. Uh-huh. And then we do some things with like tennis balls, or with the little soft ones.
Yeah.
Or with bottles with some things in, which make some noise, some funny noises. All fun stuff.
So probably very different, probably different to how you started, I guess.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, it's completely different.
Yeah. So I want to talk to you a little bit about how you first found out about the fact that you got rheumatoid arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you learn that in the first place?
Well, it was kind of a journey. I had a right wrist which was very sore. So I went to the hospital and they make some X-rays. And then in the first place, it was not broken, but the other one
sprained.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, just at this age, how old were you at this stage?
11.
11, okay, right.
And then, so they put me in Blaster for 2 weeks. And then after that, it was broken, mm-hmm. which was very, uncommon. It should have been healed instead of being worse.
Yeah.
And then it took me for like, I think, 6 weeks or so in the Blaster again. Blaster, and then I went to the physio to get it starting moving again, and that process was really sore because it didn't move. So what the physio did, he tried his utmost, but it was not working. And then I had a surgery in Nijmegen, and they took some whatever stuff out.
A biopsy.
Exactly.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah, exactly. But nothing came out. And then the next step was Amsterdam. And there was a team with seven guys that were all had a specialism on hands and wrists. And I came in there, and the first thing he said was, "Have you ever been to a rheumatic doctor?" So no. So it was two stairs up and the first door left. Go and speak there. Okay. But the blood, my blood's not, it's not, you can't see it from out of my blood. So it took a while to find it out. And the process with the physio of getting my wrist moving again, that was already rheumatic arthritis because it was getting stuck already.
Right.
So what they did then, we did another surgery, and they put a needle in, like an iron thing,
mm-hmm.
to get the process of getting my wrist stuck, to get it quicker, and to get me rid of the pain. So that was in for like 1.5 years or so, and then they took it out again, and now it's stuck,
right?
Which is fine. Yeah. No pain anymore, so that's good.
What effect did the diagnosis have on you? Because you're 11 years of age, and you now know that you're probably going to spend the rest of your life living with rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah.
So what effect did that have on you?
It did have a lot of effect, actually. I was, on a young age, I was a couple of times already out of school because I just couldn't get it right in my head and walking in circles. When I find my way, it was fine. But it took a while.
What kind of experience do you have with the rheumatoid arthritis? What are the constant?
It was more or less, it was basically always the pain.
The pain, right.
yeah, the pain and not able to make the movements with my wrist, which I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to a sports school, but I couldn't do it because there was you have to do the football, the tennis, and we also have to do the gymnastics. So I couldn't do that because my right wrist was not working. So that was a dream which crashed. So, well, then I started playing golf as, well, go, and came in the national team. And that, well, that might have made my life a lot easier because there was a goal again.
And is your RA, is that localized to your wrists or do you find it in any other joints?
No, in the wrist.
Only in the wrist.
No, it was located in the wrist, and it is now in the left elbow, right elbow, and both of the shoulders.
Okay, so that's where it started, but now it's...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So what did you tell your school friends? Because you had to have time off school, I think you mentioned a couple of times. What did you tell your school friends?
The way it was.
Right. Very Dutch, direct.
Yeah. The way it was, yeah. And I think it was more difficult to tell them that I was playing golf than that I had problems with RA.
Right. And how did they respond?
Fine.
Just
all normal. Yeah. It might be a strange country, but they made like big books with all kind of pictures in when I was in the hospital, and it was all good.
Great. Tell me about your golf now, because in a game that's traditionally been dominated by male golfers, you, to some extent, you've been a trailblazer for women in golf in Holland, and you're certainly good enough to have played in the Dutch national team for a dozen or so years. And and then, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the millennium you turned professional. There's a lot for me to dive into here, and perhaps the best place to start is about how you became good enough to make the national team in the first place, and what kind of practice schedule or routines did you have as a youngster in order to become the best player that you could become? So you can start anywhere you like on that one.
Nice. That's a good question, though. What did I do? Well, I think the most important thing is having fun. And I'd like to train to get better in whatever I do. So I picked it up with a professional of the local golf course. And from there on, we started playing and having fun, and he was teaching me, and well, we had to teach a little bit around the right wrist, for sure. But there is a lot of, my father was a very good tennis player and a good hockey player. So the feeling for the ball was there already. So that made it a lot easier. And then it all goes very quick. I played for, I think in a year, I had 9 handicap. And then I started playing in the national kiddies events. Yeah, from there you get the invite from the Dutch Federation if you want to be part of the Dutch team. Mm-hmm. And I said yes for sure. And then you come in the, well, it's a complete different program now, but you come in the program, and it's I think it was like once a month or maybe two of a month, 2 days, the weekends. We went to Papendal, which was the Dutch national sport.
I've been there.
Oh, good. Yeah. And so we had our Dutch trainings there. And then, it was two years up and then 1 year down because I had another surgery, and it was 2 years up. And then so the surgery came every time after 2 years. But I didn't want to give up. And then, I had a couple of coaches, a couple of friends on the golf course, which was good. And then, that's basically it.
So how much practice were you doing when you were at school?
More or less every day.
Okay. So yeah, you're very committed from a very young age. So I guess you had it in your mind at that stage then that this might be something not only that you were good at, but maybe did you have any ideas about being a professional at that time?
No. In the younger years, no. But I wanted to be the best player from Holland.
Right. And you won a lot of titles as an amateur golfer. So what was your most fulfilling highlight of your amateur career?
Yeah, I saw that in the list. I'm still thinking about it. It's very difficult. I think I have to say the first one. I had a bet with one of my first professionals, and he had a necklace with a golden golfer on it.
Okay.
And I loved that thing very much. So I said to him, "I want to have that thing." He said, "No. You know what? We're gonna make a bet. If you become a Dutch champion before you turn 18, I will go to Antwerpen to make a thing for you."
Okay.
And that's what it was. I became national champion before I was 18, and the thing is still around my neck.
Right. Well, I'm gonna have to. I'll see that next time. You wear it all the time?
I do.
So next time I see you, I'll ask to see
the winning necklace. Yeah, for sure. No problem.
And, I mean, obviously, some of the time you had, as an amateur golfer, you were studying, as you've just mentioned. But did you also work towards the end of your amateur career?
No. Yeah, I have. I worked on the office of my dad, but I only did that when it was rainy outside. When the sun starts shining, I'm going out to play golf.
Right. And you turned professional, as I said, around 2000 or in 2000, I think.
Yes.
Was your plan at that stage to play the tour?
Yes. And I did that for half a year. So I played qualifying school in, I think, Portugal. I'm not sure about that. And I had a conditional card, and I played a couple of tournaments in the beginning, but my body's not good enough.
Right.
So it was just too heavy. So I tried it, and then it didn't work out.
So what did you learn about your golf and also yourself when you first played professionally?
It's a good question, though. I don't like the tour life.
Right.
I don't like to be on my own, away from home, with no friends, that was basically the thing which was the most difficult. I like the game for sure.
Yep.
And I do like the traveling. I love traveling. But then with my boyfriend or my parents or the friends from the Dutch team or whatever it was. And as a professional, it was, especially in the beginning, it's a bit of a strange word, but call it bitch fighting.
Okay.
It's all, if somebody else is playing bad, the other one are laughing.
Right.
So that was my feeling. That's probably not the real world, but that's the way I felt.
Yeah.
So I didn't like it, and so for me it was not a disappointment to quit playing on tour and to go to the teaching school or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, the PGA of Holland training school. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then you've gone into the teaching school, you've gone into the training. Have you got a goal at this stage now? Have you got any kind of objective? What's going through your mind?
Now, one of the goals was becoming a national coach,
yeah.
which just happened a year ago. You know that that was one of the goals, and I'd like to go to the Paralympics as a coach or as a player, but maybe I think I have more chance as a coach. But that's high on the list. I think that's the main goal. Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier that you'd had plenty. So I'm going to come back to your job as a national coach, by the way. But you mentioned earlier that you'd had plenty of surgeries over the years, and I'm pretty certain that some of these must have affected your ability to play the game. So oh, yeah. You've obviously had to have a pretty open mindset, I would guess, to continually adjust to what is effectively an ever-changing body as a result of injury or surgery. So how have you managed to continue to have a positive mindset, I would assume, and certainly a learning mindset that said, well, okay, now I'm going to play the game, but I might have to play it in a slightly different way. How have you managed to do that?
Just never give up. Just never give up. There's always a way to play golf. There's always a way. And I always start looking for the one way which was suiting me the best. And with the coaching team around me, so with the coach from now and with the physical coach, start looking and starting to find a way which is good enough for me and for my body to play and to still have fun. And it still works out. I think more than 4 or 5 times that I shouldn't play golf anymore. But it's not that easy. So I always will find a way.
So how much work do you do with your coach and your physical coach even today?
I see, which is Debbie, you know that. I see her once a week, about 2 hours, and I speak to her about 3 times a week.
Okay.
And my golf coach, I see him, especially around the tournaments, I see him once or twice a week. But that's only for like 15 minutes. Right. Or I'm going to play 9 holes with him.
Yeah.
I saw him tomorrow, this morning, for 15 minutes.
Right.
Just to check.
Yeah.
Just to be, well, confident enough to start the weekend.
It's a little bit like having a pair of outside objective eyes, I guess.
Exactly.
So you still play competitively from time to time, and you've won a couple of professional events in Holland. So what is it about competing? Because you mentioned, you know, it would be great to play the Paralympics, to, you know, be the national champion by the end of this week, because I know you're playing in that event over the weekend. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you enjoy about competing?
Adrenaline. Just, that's it. I like the pressure. I like the, I like the pressure. That's basically it.
So what does it feel like when do you get nervous when you stand on the first tee?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I love that feeling.
Right.
Yeah, and if I start losing that feeling, I quit golf.
Yeah.
Or competitive golf.
And tell me, do you like to show off when you're hitting balls? Is that something? Because that's very common. I've spoken to lots of players over the years. And when I say show off, I don't mean it in a big-headed way. I mean, it's like being on stage that... Do you like the crowd watching? Is that something that's good for you?
Nobody watching.
Right, okay.
So no, that's not it. I played a couple of times in the Dutch ladies tour events, which is fair. It was, I think, twice or 3 times on my own course. So they gave me a wild card, and I never forget that feeling. With all the spectators and all the guys that are supporting you, which is great. But it is the nerves and the adrenaline that makes it great for me. It's not the spectators. It's good that they're there. I'm not going to be somebody else when they're there or when they're not there.
Yeah, yeah. To go back to your new job, because it's a relatively new job. I think it was in June of last year. So it's not that new, I suppose. It's almost a year by now.
Yeah.
But you were appointed by the Dutch Federation as national coach to the team of golfers with disability. So can you tell me about the work that you do with the players?
Yes. The team is now 10 players, 11 players. And what we do is we try to be together twice a month. And what I always try to do is play as much as we can. Because they all work with their own coaches. I think the most important thing is playing golf, getting the course management as good as you can on different courses, so that they use their brains on the good way. And what I do technically is only controlling if they're working if they do what they have to do from their own coach. Right. So I have I've been to all the coaches, all the private coaches, to chat about the player.
Yep.
And say, okay, what are you working on? What do you want me to do? Is this something I can control or whatever it is? And that's basically it. I talk a lot with them.
Right.
Just to give them a good feeling. And it's very important. I think it's good when everybody is happy and but all in a competitive way. So it's not that that I go to whatever you call a name, and if he plays bad, then I go there. It's a pity. No, you know, we're gonna do as normal as you should do as a coach, and I don't have to tell you. But I try to get them as confident as I can. Up to a tournament.
And is the training pretty competitive?
Yes. Yeah, we always have a goal on the course, or we play whatever. We play match play, or we play stroke play, or we put some money in. We all play for like everybody pays €5, and the winner takes all, or all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I like that.
I'm going to ask you four questions on the bounce now, which are all a little bit about the future, because obviously you've been around the game for quite a while and you've seen changes in the game. You've experienced them yourself. So the first question I'm going to ask you here is if you had the resources, and that would be human resources, financial resources, facility resources, etc., and you could make three decisions that would positively impact golf for the disabled, what would you do?
Yeah, that's a very tough one. But I think one of the most important things is that we need to find more players with a disability. And we need to make golf more fun for youngsters. I think when you go to a revalidation center, and there's young guys, and they can choose if they're in a wheelchair or whatever it is, and they can choose between tennis, basketball, or golf. I think they always will choose for basketball or baseball or tennis or whatever it is, because I think golf is still kind of boring for the youngsters, and I think that is. That's a tough cookie. How can we make it more fun, more attractive? You tell me.
It's an interesting.
Maybe you have the answer.
It's an interesting problem, obviously, and I think it's not a problem specifically for golf for the disabled. I think what you've pointed out is correct. I think if you're younger and you've got the options to play something that's relatively energetic or something that looks relatively sedentary, but we know it's not sedentary, but if we look at it as being something that's relatively sedentary and it's normally done by old people, then of course it's not very attractive. But it's interesting that when you talked about competing, you were talking about adrenaline, about pressure and about performance. And, you know, these are things that I don't care what age you are, that if you have a sporting mentality or an athlete's mentality, these are three things that you would certainly want to have in whatever the game that you choose to play. So I think there's a general misconception about golf that it is boring, it is slow. And yet I think for the people that play it, it's anything but that. And so we have to get over that. So
I know.
That aside, getting more people into the game, you've still got two choices that you can make to
positively.
Actually, I'm not going to let you off with just one.
Oh, okay.
You've still got two more decisions that you can make. Anything else that comes to mind?
Facility should be better.
Right.
I think if we go to the Dutch team, we always have the problem of the weather. So if you can go to, like, for example, Portugal during winter times, because there's money enough, you can make the Dutch team better.
Right.
But that's only 11 or 10 players.
Yeah.
So I still get stuck at the point, where can we find more players?
Yeah.
We need more players. As Edgar, as the Dutch team, as every European country, there should be loads of disabled players.
Yeah.
Where are they?
Yeah, I think you're right. We know the World Health Organization tells us that 15% of the world is disabled.
Exactly.
That's a whole bunch of people when you consider 7 mm-hmm. billion people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to some degree, golf has the chance, which perhaps some other sports don't, in that not every sport can be played by people with every disability. And I think
exactly.
Golf perhaps might be one of the few that can be played by a very wide group of people with disability. So
that's what I said. There's always a way.
Yeah. So I think we do have some options there. And certainly, as far as Edgar's concerned, and I know many of the federations that make up Edgar, they're working hard to try and get more people to engage with the sport. And the first touch is obviously very important, so that when somebody tries it, then if they like it, then they've got a seamless transition into some kind of program that allows them to learn to continue to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't like it, that's fine, but at least they're informed about the game.
Exactly.
Which is also a result. It's also a good result.
Yeah, maybe for guys in a wheelchair who can't stand anymore, if you be in a barra golfer, you can stand again.
Yeah.
Which might, I think it is a very good experience.
Well, I've done several interviews with people that are in para golfers, and it's been really interesting to hear their comments about exactly what you've just mentioned, that the world looks very different from the day where they were able to stand on their own to the day
mm-hmm.
that they were not able to stand and they had to sit. And it's a
for
different
sure.
perspective, of course.
Yeah.
And I know for some it's been a real boost to their mentality just to be able to stand up. And
exactly.
There's a story that really is one that gets the hair standing up on the back of your neck when the player mentioned that to be able to stand up for the national anthem was just something that was incredible.
Yeah.
But of course, as well, for a health perspective, that having sat down for so long, to be able to just stand up, and for physically, that's good. I guess another question I can't let you get away with is, what about getting more women with disability into golf? Because, I mean, clearly there's an imbalance. There's an imbalance in the mainstream sport. There's an imbalance in disability sport. And I can understand that perhaps more males acquire disabilities, such as amputations and paralysis, perhaps due to machines that go faster and war, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, there doesn't seem to be enough women with disability, with any disability, involved in disabled golf. And do you think there's a way for us to be able to attract more of them into the game?
Yeah, we spoke about that in Portugal already, maybe.
Yes.
Maybe that. Yeah. Well, I think it's. I think we have to make it easier for them. I think there are more ladies with a disability, but the thing is that they might be that it's a bridge too far to go and play international tournaments or start with national tournaments because they think they're not good enough. So that you might make the golf courses easier. As you play in a para golfer, you can't hit the ball as far as I can, or as Mette can, or Daphne, or whatever it is. And Monique will always hit the ball 100 meters shorter, or 80, than we do. But she still has to play on the same golf course, which makes it, well, I guess a lot more difficult for her than it is for me.
Yeah.
So, there's a thing we can, well, maybe we should make two different courses in one course for her.
Right.
So that you play from like. What we have in Holland, and I don't know if that's common in Europe, we have Orange Tee, where we can play, well, the juniors or the seniors or whatever it is. And you can put all the ladies' para golfers on that tee, which makes it easier. Which makes it easier to make a good score.
Yeah.
I think if Monique is very, she's really has a sport mentality.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that and you have to play in an international tournament, you shot like 110, that's no fun.
Do you think tournaments are as important to women as, as perhaps to men? I'm not talking about you. I'm not talking about
national
teams, but I'm talking about in general. Because ideally what it's about is getting more women with disability to participate, whether they play in tournaments or not, to a large extent, is not that important. What's important is that they participate in the game and get some of the benefits from the game, even if they're only playing social golf, that's fine.
But then still, I think you need to make it easier, because if it's too difficult, they won't do it.
Yeah, understood.
And I think that the ladies or the females will get. There's always the boys that are more fanatic and all that kind of stuff. But I think the ladies will come. They come closer. I think.
Yes.
I think it's changing.
Yes. I see that. I see that definitely. What does the future hold for Marcella?
Well, I'm actually quite happy with the way it goes like this. So I hope to get it on for a couple of years like this.
Yeah.
Stay fit and have some fun with the team. Have some fun for myself on the golf course and play some tournaments around. That you can make it happen. I can play. Playing in the tournaments and having fun as a coach with the students and having fun back home is fine with me.
Yeah, I think just on that subject of the tournaments, I think it will happen. We've had this conversation before, but it will happen, I'm sure, because the line between professionals and amateurs is constantly blurring.
I know.
So it will definitely be a different world in, who knows, whether that's 2 years' time, 5 years' time, 10 years' time.
Yeah,
it will be a different world.
But I think still it's very, very strange that if I have a disability, it doesn't matter if I'm a professional or an amateur.
Yeah.
Disability is a disability.
Absolutely. I have full agreement with you, and certainly that's why Edgar has this open golf policy, and we all play together, amateurs and professionals, ladies and men, and it's an open golf
which I like very much. Yeah.
But that's not the same for every organization, and they eventually, I'm sure, will have that kind of philosophy, because that's what the world is demanding now. And we can see that in not just in golf, but in all sports and in all parts of society. And so it should be. I think that as long as people are informed then it's up to them to make their decision. And I, for whatever it's worth, and for my experience in golf, for whatever that's worth, is that once people are fully informed, I think you can trust them to make the right decision. I think a lot of bad decisions are made because people are badly informed and they don't understand or they don't realize. And I think when that changes, and I think there's been over the years, perhaps there's been a lot of trying to push people into a corner to make them to do things, but without telling them in the first place and explaining to them, and or debating with them even, because sometimes it's a debate that beliefs are funny things that, you know, once you've got a belief, there can be a lot of evidence that says that belief is wrong, and yet people stick to their old belief. And it's amazing,
well,
but it's true.
Then.
Yeah, it's true. So they have to be brought along with new evidence, with good arguments, with good debate. And then I think once they're fully informed, they make better decisions. And so that's, I think, all we can do. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. Hopefully it does. But anybody who needs to be informed, if they're informed properly, there's a good chance that they'll make better decisions, and they will then influence other people to make better decisions because they can have a proper conversation. So, that's kind of the way that I see it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I've got one more question for you, which you can imagine, which is, if you could offer one piece of advice to someone who, like yourself, received a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis or some other kind of diagnosis with disability being the end result, as a youngster, what piece of advice would you give them?
Go out and go play and do any sport. Don't go and sit and be inside. You go outside and move as much as you can.
Good advice. If people wanted to reach you, Marcella, how would they do? How would they find you?
Marcella Neggers, 75@gmail.com.
Super. Well, Marcella, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. I know I'm going to see
no
you
problem.
In a few weeks' time in your coaching role at the Europeans.
Yeah, for sure.
Hopefully you'll have some success, and I'm going to make sure that I have a look to see that necklace that was your prize for being a national champion under 18 years of age.
I will always have it with me.
Great.
No problem.
Marcella, take care.
Okay, Tony.
Thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye.
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.